This is Lou Elizondo, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Danny, let's just carry on. A lot to get through. Stephen asks a good question. He asks, does Danny think that what is happening now with disclosure is really a battle between the gatekeepers and the public, or is it a battle between factions of the gatekeepers that has become partially public?
It's the latter. There's no doubt. It's a battle between the gatekeepers and the people inside the governmental circles that have gotten fed up with this, and that they're trying to get more of the information out. But it's important to remember that the people that are inside the government that are trying to get out more information about the UFO issue themselves are not fans of releasing all of it, you know, and that they, in my judgment, probably would keep more of it secret than they should. And so that we as the citizens need to become involved. We need to shift this over into the former situation where it's the American citizens and the public in the United States that are confronting the national security state, that we're stepping through our present representatives, giving them an opportunity to join us in this and to do their job constitutionally. But if they don't, we've got to be able to perform. That's what the New Paradigm Institute is here for, is to do the actual disclosure ourselves, to develop the kind of levels of confidence in the whistleblowers themselves, and to be able to convince them that we're capable of protecting them and their future careers. That's what we're doing right now. It's still the latter of the two situations you point out. It's a battle of factions, the black hats versus the gray hats, as you will. And the citizens are the white hats, you know, that are trying to get this information revealed. And the New Paradigm Institute represents the white hats. But we're in dialogue and in negotiations with the black hats through the offices of the gray hats. that's what's really happening here.
Do you think there's a strong chance then, if things do go your way, the New Paradigm Institute gets to push forward what it's hoping to do, that those factions just become even more splintered as a disclosure movement happens? I know, speaking to people like Richard Dolan, Bryce Zabel, you know, co-authored a book, After Disclosure, together, there's a lot of talk about, you know, there would be new types of insurances would come out. There would be people in the military suing for past, you know, discretions, you know, being dismissed wrongly. Mm-hmm. There would be people even going to the far side of things would then be looking at getting insured against abductions. That would all become a part of daily life before you even get into new technologies that all of a sudden private aerospace companies suddenly come into the possession of and can start releasing to a public for profit. All that's got to be considered as well, hasn't it?
Well, that's one of the challenges, Andy, is that all of those kind of issues ought to be being addressed right now. That we ought to be solving those kind of problems and answering those kind of questions, but the people are still declining to engage in that activity. They're still at the kind of, they think that there's a dam here, that since the government officials haven't quite officially acknowledged the whole reality of this thing, that they're busy doing something else. You know, everybody's busy doing things other than that, than answering these questions. That's one of the things the New Paradigm Institute is devoted to doing, is leaning forward and seeing what these questions really are and try to get these things answered now, so that we're reaching out to a number of the law school professors, deans of various law schools, trying to get law review articles written about how we're going to come to grips with these things. We're working with people that are reaching out to other people in the different universities, in the different fields of philosophy and theology and economics and geopolitics, you know, that we're trying to get people to move into a mindset where they're actually working at answering these questions without being ridiculed. You know, the long time, you know, 75-year effort on the part of the national security state to shame people, to threaten people, to ruin their careers if they tried to deal with these things professionally, you know, it still has effect. There's still lingering effects of that kind of long-term program. And so that what we've got to do is try to get through that and move into the actual process of answering these questions, which we, and what we're doing is we're trying to recruit different factions from inside the national security state, from inside the Congress, from inside the political parties. We're trying to recruit them to become participants with the citizens in this activity, so that we're actually both empowering our constitutional structures, but we're also empowering our citizens to push back against the national security state people, you know, so that we have a team that's ever growing, so that by the time we get to succeed in this, virtually all the people will be on our side, except for that really insulated group that we will have cornered and identified. And then you get to the question of, you know, what type of amnesty are you going to grant to them? What kind of immunity might you grant to them in order to get them to come forward and provide more information so that we can solve this problem in its full range of implications, you know? So that's the answer to this, is that we're trying to empower the citizens to become the people who are confronting the national security state directly, in alliance with all of our constitutional structures and as many of the factions as we can recruit.
A question from Mikey. Mikey asks, he wants me to push you on a previous statement you've made on various shows and podcasts, Danny, around the people in the know being aware of around 5 or 6 ET species,
yes,
you know, separate different species. He wants you to elaborate, you know, how do you know, or how do we know there are 5 or 6 different species? What is it that's differentiating them?
Well, what we have is, in addition to the work that we've been doing through the New Paradigm Institute that has been in operation basically since I got retained by Lou Elizondo. And Lou Elizondo has come forward, and he and Chris Mellon and Grush and some of the others from inside have been making inside information available to us that's kind of got an official imprimatur. There's thousands of interviews of people that have had direct contact with actual occupants of these vehicles. And it's something that none of the government institutions want to talk about right now. You know, that, you know, you even sitting down talking face to face with any one of the senators that is very much in favor of revealing whether or not there's been a crash retrieval program or not. excuse me. That the one thing they don't want to talk about is, well, what about the people that have actually had face-to-face contact with any of the occupants? They just immediately say, whoop, nope, we're not going there. Don't include me in on that. I don't want to be involved in any kind of conversations where I appear to be confirming that. And so that we're into a different package of information here. And that is that, you know, for example, we have here at the New Paradigm Institute numerous direct real-time live interviews of people who are recounting the details of their personal face-to-face contacts and are investigating each of those to make sure that they're credible. And, you know, we're capable of weeding out the people that are loonies or that are, you know, that have got some kind of mental illness, or they're wannabes, or they're shills that are making stuff up, that we've been culling out these kind of totally credible people. And what we get is this rather consistent account of this handful of different species, you know. And I mean, there are some people say, oh, they say there's 157 species, or there's 1,000 different kinds of species. Well, clearly inside the entire galaxy, you know, that you're going to have a large number of planets with different species of extraterrestrial intelligence. But those that are repeatedly referenced here that are coming are obviously the small grays, you know, that everybody, when you ask a kindergartner in the country now to draw an ET person, they'll draw that person. They'll draw the little short 3.5 foot tall, you know, ET with a large head and the big dark eyes and the little holes for nose. They'll do it. Okay. And then there is the tall grays, and these are like, you know, 5.5 to 6 feet tall people that are like, look like grown up grays. And so that there's the tall grays as well. And then there are the reptilians that people have heard about, and they get really bad press but they shouldn't. I think it's just because people, human beings, have this kind of recoiling from serpents and dangerous poisonous snakes and things, and so that there's this kind of adverse reaction to reptiles. But the fact is that we have numerous accounts of extraordinarily cordial, positive encounters between human beings and these reptilian beings, and that they give off very positive, friendly vibes. And it's just that we kind of recoil cellularly from these beings. But it's important for people to remember that we came through that process. The whole evolution of life on our planet, Homo sapiens came through that process and repeat the process in the womb, you know, of actually having a stage of the zygote for each one of us that was in this kind of reptilian form, you know, with the gills and the tail and the living in a liquid ambience, you know, I mean, so that we will be able to get people past this kind of bad press that's been generated about them. And people like David Icke's and others have gone off on tangents of picking up on these mythologies. Oh, that they're from Zeta Reticuli and they're the reptilians and they're in some kind of pitched battle with the good white people that look like Aryan human beings that are from the Pleiades, you know, and they've latched on. The Scientologists have done the same thing. You know, they've locked on to that kind of a mythos, you know, but I don't credit that. I think that the reptilian people from another star system are just as entitled to respect and openness to cordial relations as any of the others. And then there is, of course, the big, tall, what they call mantis types, that they consider, they look like, they remind people of praying mantis. And they say it over and over again. People who've had no contact with each other, have had no kind of a history of knowing anything about this, they keep thinking that when they're asked, like, what do they look like? They always keep using these terms. They look like a praying mantis. They're big, huge, tall, like 7 feet tall, extremely skinny, you know, but they've all got the three fingers, you know, the extraordinary thing is these are all like bipeds. These are bipeds and they've got arms and hands and head and torsos. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary. This particular group of UFO people that have been encountering our human beings come within this fairly tight group. And any of the other assertions of any other species are kind of outliers. And there's this other one, which I find to be very problematic, this thing about these tall, Aryan, blonde-haired, blue-eyed human beings from the Pleiades. You know, I mean, it seems to me almost to be a little bit of a bridge too far. You know, it's this kind of desperate attempt to suggest that we're them or they're us, you know, out there. And that therefore, you know, we don't have to come to grips with the kind of cellular recoil that we have, you know, built in that people talk big all the time, but I can tell you from what I've talked to lots and lots of people, you know, no matter how confident they are that they're going to be cool when this happens, you know, when they actually come face to face with an extraterrestrial being, their entire cellular structure that's been generated over billions of years and tens of thousands of years of human evolution instantaneously recoil, and the people are afraid, you know. And so that one of the things that Dr. John Mack and I were doing back before John was accidentally killed in 2004, you know, what we were doing is, he was doing it primarily, is training people who were repeated contactees to do holotropic breathing. So the minute that they thought they were going to get ready to have another one of these encounters that's frightened them, is that they would do the deep holotropic breathing and that they would get calmed and centered so that when the beings appeared, they would be centered and calm and could actually have communication with them. And that we were actually in the process of providing questions to them. We were kind of, John and I were trying to develop at the New Paradigm Institute that we were trying to establish up at in Cambridge. you know, that they would actually be like an ambassador corps that mm-hmm. could actually ask questions so that we could start getting some inside information about the cultures and stuff of the people. But that's what we were engaged in when John was accidentally killed in London back in 2004. But we're still in that thing, our New Paradigm Institute, that we're, as I say, interviewing people who've had these kind of contacts. We have numerous recordings, live recordings of their sessions of being debriefed about this. I've interviewed people when I was legal counsel at the Project for Extraordinary Research with Dr. Mack. So that this cadre of five or so species that are consistently reported has become so commonplace now among extraordinarily credible witnesses that this is where our New Paradigm Institute is focusing our attention right now.
No, thank you for that answer. I've got a whole load of ways I could go off of that, but we don't have time to keep going on that one question.
Okay.
Question from Gary. Gary asks, does Danny have any idea if the photos he saw of a crashed saucer were from a known case in ufology?
No, I do not believe it is a known case in ufology, because nowhere else have I seen anybody that could show the symbols that were on that particular craft. That's the only place that I've ever seen them. That the ones that I traced out are unique. You know, in that we've got references to different types of symbols, you know, from the Roswell crash off the little beams. They've got other people who have asserted that they've seen different kinds of symbols on the craft. But this particular one, I've seen no replication of this at all. And I've never seen any photographs that look anything like the particular craft that I saw. I mean, except that it was rather classic. I mean, it was, as I say, it had skidded across this field. You've probably heard me talk about, you know, skidded across this field. It had the snow and it had plowed up the dirt and it was stuck in the side of the embankment. So it was that I've heard of cases like that where they've skidded through fields and hit into some kind of a embankment and they're stuck at some kind of an angle. I've heard of a few of those, but any of those that I've ever seen photographs of or drawings, renditions of those, have not been the one that I saw.
If anyone wants more information on the background of that, I suggest you check out the interview with Danny I done a few months back. Just search it in the podcast feed and you'll find more info, or any other interview Danny's done on that. I suggest you go and find those too. Stephen asks, can you ask Danny if he knows if President Carter got the talk from the CIA, which left him crying?
That one, I've had that. I don't know about that one. I've heard it as you have, but that when I was working on the project back in 1977, all the way through, I guess, into 78, I was still working with them. I hadn't gotten any information that he was given the two reports that were prepared by the Science and Technology Division of the Congressional Research Service, and it would have had to have been in his one term, otherwise he would not have been briefed at all. But I know that the CIA director George Bush refused to brief him. I know that when he tried to get Teddy Sorensen appointed to be the CIA director, who I anticipated had a desire to have a fairly close relationship with Ted, but he got rejected. He got pushed out by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Howard Baker forced him out. And then when the new fellow came in, I never got any information that President Carter continued to demand the information from Stansfield Turner, or that Turner ever turned it over to him, because we had this confrontation with Stansfield Turner because of the Karen Silkwood case. You know, that we had dug up the information that they were smuggling 98% pure bomb grade plutonium out of the Kerr-McGee nuclear facility in Cimarron, Oklahoma, to go to Israel and to Iran under the Shah. And because of that, we conveyed that information to John Dingell, who was the congressman from Detroit, Michigan. And he was the chair of the subcommittee of the House Commerce Committee on Energy and the Environment. And we provided the information to him directly, and he confronted Stansfield Turner. So we had this kind of adverse relationship with Stansfield Turner. I was never given any kind of inside privy information from what, but I've just heard the story. But, you know, you've heard the story of, you know, Pope John Paul II, you know, being shown, opened the letter, the secret letter of the third secret at Fatima, and then crying and refusing to tell anybody. You know, these are mythology flies all around in this particular subject. I would still view that to be mythology, because I would have assumed that President Carter would have said something about this because of his devotion to being honest and forthright. And especially now, as he's approaching the clear final months, if not years, of his life, that he would say something about it, and he has not, as far as I know. And I don't know how anybody would know that, you know.
Yeah, no, of course. Very interesting question here from 30 World Danny. Danny Sheehan has said that he is on friendly terms with Jaime Maussan, and also he himself believes the Nazca specimens are real and not hoaxes. Could you ask him if the New Paradigm Institute is willing to work with the international contingent of researchers to further the study of the Nazca specimens?
Well, here, let me be clear about what this is.
I was just about to ask you there. Is that
I've told Jaime, and I've told, you know, Michael Mazzola, and the other folks that are working, bringing the United States people, the forensic scientists and stuff, mm-hmm. down to Peru about this. I said, look, I'm perfectly happy to be cooperative with everybody, but, you know, until such time as that I have been given information that shows that this is connected in any way to the UFO thing, or that these are extraterrestrial beings in some way, that we're not going to have any kind of formal relationship. And I'm not going to say anything formally publicly about this, that based upon my secondhand conversations with the people that have seen the bodies, that have been present for the studies of the large bodies, not the little guys, mm-hmm. the little short people, there seems to be a consensus from the people that I know and trust that these have been put together. They've been crafted. But ironically, it was like 1,000 years ago. The carbon dating of these are extraordinarily old, but they appear to be constructed. Now, as to who could have constructed something as sophisticated as that 1,000 years ago is a secondary question. But with regard to the 5 feet tall Nazca mummies, that the kind of tests that have been performed on them are extremely convincing, that these are organic beings. And that the preliminary test, one of the challenges is that the preliminary DNA tests that have been run on those bodies down in Peru are not with the most sophisticated equipment, scientific equipment that's available. And so people have been trying to figure out how we can get those bodies brought to the United States to be examined with the most sensitive and sophisticated medical equipment to check the DNA, et cetera, of these. But the preliminary DNA tests that have been done down there on the larger beings, and there's a number of them.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot more of them that are still in the original place where they've been where they were recovered. But these few bodies that they have, the tall, 5 foot tall Nazca mummies, that they've done the preliminary DNA tests on them, and they say that like a third of the DNA is of some it's a primate of some kind, an earthly primate of some kind of early ape type animal, and then another 10% of them are human DNA, Homo sapien DNA. But then there's another, you know, 70% of them or something that that is completely unknown. The DNA is completely unknown. They've been unable to match it with any other known DNA specimen of any species on our planet. Now, you have to take into account what the scope of their ability to do that is. You know, what access do they have there down in Peru to do that at the particular facility to be definitive like that? That's a question. But the process is underway. That some people are more inclined to believe that they're UFO related or ET related than others. But that I keep counseling people to be very careful about this. You know, you don't want to discredit the entire UFO ET movement for disclosure that's underway right now by getting out on a limb on something like that and then having it sawed off behind you. You know, that's and it's perfectly clear that there's a kind of a cottage industry down in South America of people who are poor and don't have any means of income of kind of selling things like this to people and even engaging in some kind of con game that's going on in parallel with all of this that causes us to be extra cautious about this. So I've been very careful about not taking any position on this publicly or anything officially in the name of the New Paradigm Institute. We've been asked repeatedly to participate in this, and the people that are involved, Jaime Masson and Michael and some of the other people that are involved in this are friends of mine, are personal friends of mine that I've known for years, decades, in fact, in terms of Jaime. But they get very enthusiastic about about preliminary information and may not be as careful as I think we need to be at the New Paradigm Institute to maintain our credibility on this. And to be the most helpful to people so that they can be completely reliant upon something that the New Paradigm Institute is willing to say, you know, because we have had tight vetting going on about the information that we support.
I think that's sensible, and I won't be hypocritical and sit here, Danny, and say that I'm fully confident that this is a genuine situation that we're seeing unfold. That it was very emotive for people. I've discussed it a few times from a layman's point of view. The YouTube comments were extremely split on it in a way I've never seen before, which is, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, and just like the UFO topic at the minute, no one knows, we don't know. So it is down to get scientists involved, these three Americans involved. Fantastic, the more the merrier. I've said, and Jaime's a friend of yours, I think, Danny, the optics of the situation have been horrendous from the get-go. I think the presentation of the whole thing has been awful. And if this is something that's genuine, the way it's been put forward hasn't been good, just from my opinion, and some people disagree with that and they're more than entitled to do so. But when you can't get live streams working, when you're breaking bits of the bodies off, and I think that enthusiasm is a good word, because sometimes it's misdirected. It can just be, you know, maybe center things a little bit, and like you say, let's see. I would love for it to be genuine. I would love for these to be some kind of non-human entity or early primate we have no idea of, and it changes our understanding of evolution. But I think that sort of remains to be seen, Danny. Last couple of questions, if you don't mind, before we finish up. Question from Shadowwise. I recently watched a video revealing aerogel drones as the secret technology that was being tested on Dave Fravor that we refer to as the Tic Tac. It also sounded like they were saying these were the craft that Ryan Graves encountered as well. Do you believe this to be a truth, a diversion, or a bit of both?
No, we don't know yet. I mean, that one of the old adages I always like to say is, you know, we don't get paid to guess these things. You know, we don't get paid at all. As it turns out, we get contributions from citizens to support us doing highly credible information and analysis, and that's what we're doing here. That there's no doubt at all that there's an extraordinary set of developments that have been going on in the field of drone technology. Okay, and we just saw the display this past weekend with Iran, you know, launching, you know, I guess there were maybe 80 missiles, but the rest of the 200 objects were like drones that they were firing into Israel. So there's tons of these drones around, and there's differing forms of these things, but the ability of these objects that have been seen by Flavor and the others are still performing movements that are beyond the understanding of physics right now. Mm. So this would have to be more than just simple an extension of drone technology. There's still certain principles of physics that seem to be at play here that are beyond what we understand to be the boundaries of physics that we've understood so far. So it's not likely that it's just a regular drone that's somehow been souped up with some additional technology. But those are still very weird. People keep missing out on this. I mean, they're talking about these little circular globes with rectangles in them, with like a box inside them, with all kinds of data and stuff. But the stuff inside the stuff is what's so important. The people that know anything about this stuff know what that means. That the images that are inside some of those orbs in the little rectangles, the box that's inside them, it's some kind of special symbols that mean something to some people, and they're trying to study those things right now to see what those things are all about. I don't think that that's any kind of traditional technology that those guys have been running into.
Cubes inside of spheres.
That's right. They're cubes inside of spheres. That those little weird things that they're going on around. And there's a number of things that are being conflated with. I'm primarily focused, and I know the New Paradigm Institute, on the classic UFOs. The classic UFOs are the saucers, you know, that can pick people up and they bring people inside them. They have occupants flying them around. These are things that are kind of fully occupying our attention at the initial level of this investigation. To say that, you know, that if these things are true, all you have to have is one of those. How many UFO vehicles do you have to prove beyond any reasonable doubt have extraterrestrial beings of a different species communicating with our people and telling them where they're from, you know, et cetera? How many of those do you need to have once you get one or two of them that are absolutely convincing? And that's what we're trying to deal with. And it's integrating that knowledge of the verification of intelligent life elsewhere in our universe, intelligent and highly technologically developed life, non-human life, and the fact that they're coming and going from here. Those are the key features of the UFO phenomenon that we have to come to grips with initially in order to integrate into our culture. Not only its technology, but it's the theological and philosophical implications of that, the geopolitical implications of that, all of these things that we need to get these questions identified and answered, and then we can extend out to these other more esoteric aspects of it. But there are some things that I think are just in a different category, you know, and that is the stuff that's happening on Skinwalker Ranch and stuff, for example, that. You know, portals that have been talked about, you know, down through the centuries. Indigenous people have talked about these portals and ghost-like beings. And there's all kinds of discussions about leprechauns and dwarfs and other kind of things that people have associated with the, quote, unknown, or that are anomalous in their nature, is not what we're focused on. You know, we're focused on the UFO phenomenon. And the non-human intelligent life that appears to be associated with them. That's the key for our initial focus on these questions.
Can I just remind you back, you mentioned the cubes inside the spheres, the symbology with on those. You say they're trying to study those. Is that because they've got one of them, or is that because they've got really good footage and pictures of them that they can study?
Good pictures. It's primarily good pictures. They've got really good pictures of these because they've come so close to the craft that the F-18s can get really close up. And some of the guys inside the F-18s have brought their high resolution personal cameras with them, and they're taking pictures of them out of the window. I mean, they've got those photos of them. They're not just the gun camera, but I mean, actual, Nikon photographs of those things right up close to the craft, so they've been able to look at these things and they're trying to figure out what all this means.
I heard of one pilot that got so close to one of these, they defecated in their suit because they were so taken aback by what they were looking at that was next to them. And these are the creme de la creme of the people that, that's not a drone they're looking at. They know what they're looking at and what they're not looking at. Last question then from Teflon Eddie. He asks, in previous interviews, you have discussed the visit wherein you made notes from documents relating to the UFO hieroglyphs, we'll call them. This appeared to have been a significant moment for you coming into the UFO topic. Yeah. What moment since then has come to underpin your discovery, your perspective, your belief on the UFO phenomenon?
Well, another one, I've mentioned it. Someone else asked me that question, was the event surrounding the telegram that was in the hand of General Ramey, that famous photograph where he contacted the people from the Roswell local newspaper and called their editor out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and ordered him to send a photographer back out to the base because he wanted the photographer to take photographs of this this weather balloon debris, right? And so he could get it in the front page of the newspaper the very next day. And General Ramey is kneeling down, is on one knee, kind of pointing and gesturing toward all weather balloon stuff. And he's got a cable in his hand, a telegram of some sort. You can see it in his hand. And when I first saw this thing decades ago, I said, holy mackerel, look at that. I said, that is something. He's got some kind of a cable, some kind of a military communique in his hand. I can see it. So I was hoping that someday we would have the technology by means of which we might be able to blow that up. It must have been 1994 or 95, as I recall. It was back then I was at the International UFO Congress when it was still at Laughlin, Nevada. And I just presented an update on what we were doing on the John Mack case back at Harvard. And I'd been asked to come and give everybody an update on how that was going. And I got done with my talk, and a guy comes up out of the audience said to me, Mr. Sheen, he said, I've got something really important to talk with you about. Can you meet me up in my room? And I went, wait a second. So I went and got a friend of mine, and we went up together. And he said, look, I think I have found the photographer for the Roswell newspaper that was called in to take that picture in the middle of the night. I said, oh, look it. If it's the right guy, I said, if you can possibly find out that he kept the negatives of that, because it was kind of an historic event, maybe he kept them. And if he did, that we may be able to get those digitized and blown up so that they can be read. He got all excited about it. And so we did that. He went and saw the guy, and it turns out it was the guy. It turns out he did have the negatives. And so we went through the process of getting those things digitized. And there was some kind of, in the folds of the telegram, you could see portions of some of the words. And so that we had some computer technology at that point. Probably the AI can do a lot better at it now, but they were able to, in light of the vowels in consonants that they could see, they could construct some more of the words. And these are available now. We actually brought those to Peter Jennings, I guess he was ABC News. I can't remember which one. But Peter Jennings was so excited about this that he actually had a television show. He used the kind of cachet that he had at ABC or wherever it was, that he got them to agree to have a 30-minute special that he went on television and showed people this. And in it, it says, you know, take the disc to right field and bring the bodies, you know, or the victims, bring those, you know, that's not a weather balloon. You know, that's not a weather balloon. So as soon as I saw that, I said, you know, bingo, you know, you put that together with the photographs that I saw it wasn't that I wasn't functionally convinced that the UFO phenomenon was real and that extraterrestrial life existed and that some of them were apparently coming and going from our planet. But I was, as a lawyer, I was looking for kind of more firsthand, immediate kind of evidentiary information that you could put in front of a jury, you know, that didn't rely strictly upon your own credibility, you know, something that you'd seen. But here's the photograph, right? A real time photograph. And so those are the two things. And then in addition to the kind of people that I interviewed, that when I was interviewing people through the Project for Extraordinary Experience Research at Cambridge with John Mack, you know, that even though I could filter through a lot of the people that may be a little bit unbalanced or emotional or not emotional, but, you know, a little unbalanced, and I would not place a lot of credibility on them, but there were other people that were extraordinarily convincing witnesses that were very real and very credible. So I started to assemble individual stories of a direct contact that people had had. and I continued to do that when I got asked by Stephen Greer to be the legal counsel for the Disclosure Project. He had done numerous interviews with people. And so I was vetting through those people to find out who I thought were the most credible people. I got to do the same thing again in 2013 with Steve Bassett in the citizens hearings we had with the former senator and former Congress people that were on a panel that were listening to those witnesses. So I've acquired lots and lots of detailed information, a lot of firsthand witnesses that I've talked to, et cetera. But those two events, the photographs in the classified portion of Project Blue Book that I saw in the spring of 1977, and the photographs of the cable that was in the hand of General Ramey, are two of the major issues that have that I can cite as direct kind of admissible evidence that have persuaded me that this is true.
I want to finish with one last question directed for you, Danny, because so many people, including myself, ask you questions relating to other people or things you're involved in. And I want to ask you, you're a constant in the UFO topic over the decades for many people. You've been involved, I think, in the extremes. People would use Stephen Greer to Lou Elizondo and so much in between, various different groups and factions or whatever you want to call them. For you, has that ever, or does it ever get overwhelming to be so involved in so much and be kind of pulled from pillar to post in that way?
No, not at all. You know, I've been very blessed. I mean, I was able to get a full scholarship to go to Harvard College. You know, my father was the first Sheehan man in our family that ever even graduated from high school. So I got to go to Harvard College and study foreign policy under Henry Kissinger. I got to study, you know, sociology under Reisman and all of these folks. Got to go to Harvard Law School and study constitutional law under Lawrence Tribe, you know, and international law under Louis Sohn. And I was the chief research assistant to Professor Jerome Cohen on international law at Harvard. And so I've been blessed. You know, I got to go to the number one litigation law firm in the world and represent the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, get to look at all 47 volumes of the Pentagon Papers, you know, before they were actually made available publicly. You know, I've been privileged to be in these kind of positions. And so I just said that, you know, I have to just take in stride what it is that I might be able to do at any given time and always think expansively, you know, of what role that I might be able to play to help the citizens. And I've always stayed devoted to the interests of the public itself, you know, and not being dragged into, you know, substituting for the public interest, the interests of a particular law firm or any particular client. I've told every single client I've ever represented, I've always said, look, you know, that I'm going to be representing you for free for public interest. And so it's the public interest that we're really representing here. So we need to have this understanding at the top of this thing. I'm not here just to get you money, you know, or settle something and have them give you a bunch of money and have you go away. You know, that's not what we're doing here. You know, this is a different type of legal representation. You know, I view myself as a people's advocate and a public interest advocate. So I'm not surprised by the fact that I get contacted by people who share that desire to have information available to the public. I have to point out that there's not a lot of competition for this position. You know, so that, you know, it's not as though there's a lot of other lawyers that have been around from Harvard or anywhere else that are willing to get out on the limb here with these things. But now, as it's becoming more and more accepted, people always say to me, how in the world did you ever get involved in something like this? You know, well, I got involved with it back before it was at all popular. You know, it was still this total outlier, you know, on these things. And I've been willing to do that and to exercise what I thought was a good judgment as to what I thought was going to one day become more and more central to people's decision-making about our country. And this is one of those things, probably the primary one. I've always known that this is going to become central to readjusting our entire human perspective on where we are in the universe. And it has very intense theological and philosophical implications for our human family. And I couldn't think of anything more interesting or important to devote my life to. I'm perfectly happy doing this. I literally get out of bed each morning going, okay, oh boy, you know, here we go. We get to pursue, you know, whether it's, you know, proving that the Israelis are getting nuclear weapons grade material in the Kerry Silkwood case and get them to stop doing that. Or to stop, you know, the reckless building of more and more of these private nuclear power plants that are threatening entire states with blowing up and killing everybody, you know, or to stop the smuggling of weapons and stuff to these right-wing death squads in South America. I mean, you know, even when I stop and look back on these cases, say, holy shit, these are really interesting cases, you know, and like almost any lawyer would want to be involved in them if there was no risk involved at the very beginning. But there always is. And that I've been willing to subject myself to that risk. And so far it's proven to be okay. You know, that I've developed, I think, an ability to distinguish people when they're telling the truth and when they aren't, to not fall for it, you know. And so I'm blessed to be able to get to do this. And I'm very privileged to get to talk with people such as yourself, Andy, and the people who listen to your show and help share the information. And it imposes an important obligation on me to be careful and credible and make sure that our new institute is adequately funded so that we can maintain staffs and we can fulfill people's expectations of us. And so far we're doing okay.
Well, Danny, there are many people out there who appreciate your many contributions to the UFO topic over the years, including myself. And even the ones who don't appreciate it, they still pay attention and listen to you when you speak. So there's always that. You're doing something right. And just behind you, Danny, you've got the Contact in the Desert logo there. I've had a few folks on who are appearing this year, including Whitney Strieber, Richard Dolan, Kelly Chase, JC King, and yourself, and Ryan Wood, of course. That's at the Renaissance Esmeralda Resort and Spa, Indian Wells, California. That's the 30th of May till June 3rd, and there are some tickets available left for the in-person event. There are also live stream tickets available. I'm doing a little giveaway on social media, so people check out for as well. You will see Danny and many others. So Danny, thank you so much for your time. I very much appreciate you spending so long with us. Sure, this time again. Okay,
I appreciate it every time. Anytime. Thank you.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and